I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you are building this state-of-the-art security fortress. I mean, we are talking about the absolute best alarms on the market, you know, thermal cameras covering every blind spot.
Right, motion sensors, laser grids, the works.
Exactly, the whole nine yards. And you spend billions of dollars setting all of this infrastructure up, only to realize, like, a few years later, that your security guards have absolutely no idea how to operate the system.
They're just sitting there.
Yeah, they're just watching the monitors while the thieves are casually walking out the back door with all your valuables.
So the facility looks impenetrable to anyone driving by, but operationally, the entire setup is just hollow.
Right. It's this shiny, incredibly expensive illusion of security. And today, for this deep dive, we're looking at an international system that has, well, historically functioned a lot like that fortress.
It really has.
We are unpacking this really comprehensive, honestly eye-opening report. It's titled From AML Rules to Real Results. And it details this profound shift in Moneyville's strategy for combating financial crime.
Yeah, it's a massive pivot.
It is. And our mission today is to help you understand why Europe's sprawling anti-money laundering framework, which let's just call it AML from here on out to save some breath, why it's getting a radical ground-up overhaul.
Right, because the goal now is moving away from simply checking legal boxes to actually physically disrupting international criminal syndicates.
Which is huge. But to grasp the scale of this policy shift, we kind of have to look at the organization driving it first.
Yeah,
Moneyville.
Right.
What exactly are they?
So Moneyval is a permanent monitoring body of the Council of Europe, and they operate as an associate member of the Global Financial Action Task Force, which most people know as the FATF.
Okay, FATF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But their role is really unique in the international landscape because, well, they don't investigate individual bank accounts.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't prosecute criminal cases or directly supervise financial institutions themselves.
Which, on the surface, feels super counterintuitive. I mean, if they are the primary watchdog for European financial integrity, what are they actually doing on a day-to-day basis?
Right. It's a fair question. They basically serve as the ultimate graders for entire governments.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They use the system of mutual evaluations. It's essentially intense peer pressure and public accountability. You have experts from various countries assessing how well a member jurisdiction complies with international standards.
Standards for, like, combating money laundering, terrorist financing, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And proliferation financing, too, which is essentially the systemic funding of weapons of mass destruction. So Moneyval evaluates the national entities, the courts, and the police forces, the people who actually do have the power to prosecute.
Got it. And for the professionals in the space listening right now, you know, you interact with this framework literally every time you open a corporate bank account.
Oh, absolutely.
Or, you know, execute a cross-border transfer or facilitate a real estate transaction. You are very familiar with the friction of source of funds declaration.
You all are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But today, we're going to explore why all that daily friction hasn't actually translated into the disruption of illicit finance.
Yeah.
And, well, how that landscape is aggressively pivoting.
So to chart where this new strategy is going, we really have to look back at the systemic blind spot that triggered the change in the first place.
Like, where did this start?
It kind of came to a head during this gathering of ministers and senior officials in Warsaw in April 2023.
Ah, the Warsaw Declaration.
Precisely. Yep. So Moneyval had been conducting its fifth evaluation round, which stretched from 2015 all the way to 2024.
That is a long time.
It is. And if you just looked at the raw data on paper for that round, it appeared to be this unmitigated success. Across all the Moneyval jurisdictions, there were 193 technical compliance ratings that were upgraded.
Wow.
And only 9 were downgraded.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. So 193 upgrades. Legally speaking, these countries were doing their homework.
Yeah, right.
They were successfully passing modern AML statutes. They were setting up financial intelligence units, demanding corporate registries, all the right things.
They were. And the strongest performances were consistently seen in, like, international cooperation and the formal supervision of banks. But, and here's the catch, at that Warsaw gathering, the ministers had to confront a pretty stark reality.
Which was?
Despite all these upgraded laws and the newly minted institutions, the framework was fundamentally failing to deliver sufficient prosecutions, convictions, and confiscations of actual criminal assets.
Oh, wow. So it sounds like a situation where a student gets an A+ on their written driver's exam. Like, They know every road sign.
Yeah.
They memorize the penal code, but they immediately crash the car the second they were forced to take the practical driving test.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. I mean, these jurisdictions built the regulatory architecture, right?
Yeah.
But they completely failed at the central policy challenge.
Which is actually using it.
Exactly. Converting that legal architecture into operational disruption.
But, you know, I want to push back on this premise just a little bit. Doesn't the mere existence of these strict laws act as an inherent deterrent to financial crime?
You would think so, yeah.
Right, because even if a country's prosecution numbers remain low, surely the fact that they adopted a modern, aggressive AML statute scares off at least a significant portion of illicit finance. I mean, nobody wants to risk it.
Well, what's fascinating here is the critical distinction the FATF makes between technical compliance and effectiveness.
Yeah.
Technical compliance is exactly what you just described. It's the act of passing the laws, requiring customer due diligence, mandating the reporting.
Checking the boxes.
Right. But effectiveness asks a much harder operational question. Does the system actually work in practice?
Mm-hmm.
Are law enforcement bodies successfully pursuing complex transnational money laundering? And the hard truth is that broad legal powers that just sit dormant on a shelf, they're not a deterrent.
Because the criminals know they won't get caught.
Exactly. Criminal syndicates employ highly sophisticated risk analysts. They really do. And if they realize a jurisdiction has tough laws, but absolutely zero capacity or willingness to enforce them in court, that jurisdiction quickly transforms into a safe haven.
Wow. So the Warsaw Declaration was really the moment Europe collectively recognized that having the laws is entirely meaningless if you aren't successfully removing criminal wealth from the legitimate economy.
Exactly. And that operational failure perfectly sets up the next major hurdle we have to talk about.
Right. Because since having the laws isn't enough, we have to ask why the practical application is stalling out. Like, why are actual meaningful prosecutions so incredibly difficult for these member states to secure?
It comes down to the staggering complexity of how illicit finance is actually structured today. I mean, money laundering is rarely this isolated offense that just happens at the end of a process.
Right.
It is the vital financial infrastructure that allows organized crime, fraud, and systemic corruption to generate sustainable economic power.
It's the engine.
Yes. And investigating a complex case requires law enforcement to reconstruct literally years of opaque financial activity, often spanning multiple international borders.
Yeah, the source material lays out the mechanics of this brilliantly.
Yeah.
We have to look at the original predicate crime, you know, the foundational offense that generates the dirty money in the first place.
Whether that's human trafficking, illegal arms sales, or just grand corruption.
Right. And that predicate crime might happen in one country, but then the proceeds are injected into the banking system in a second country.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the assets are layered and held through these anonymous trust companies or shell corporations in a third country. It's a maze.
It's a complete maze. And to unravel that specific layered structure, investigators need to subpoena banking records. They have to analyze tax information, pierce corporate veils.
Which takes forever.
Oh, and secure admissible evidence from foreign authorities who might operate under completely different legal frameworks. It's a nightmare. And once they finally gather that mountain of data, prosecutors face the monumental task of proving two things in court beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, what are they?
The criminal origin of the property and the defendant's specific knowledge or intent.
Oh, proving intent is always so hard.
It's incredibly difficult. That requires immense state resources, highly specialized financial investigators, and frankly, judges who actually understand complex corporate structuring.
Which I imagine a lot of national judicial systems simply lack.
They absolutely do.
So what do they do when they are faced with that level of complexity? I mean, they take the path of least resistance, right?
Mm.
The report points out that authorities often default to prosecuting what is known as self-laundering.
Yes. So self-laundering is when a prosecutor goes after the original offender for hiding their own illicit funds.
Okay, so it's the same guy.
Right. And because it's connected directly to the original predicate crime, it's just so much easier to prove in front of a judge.
That makes sense.
But by relying on self-laundering cases, authorities completely ignore the professional facilitators.
The enablers.
Exactly. The specialized lawyers, the accountants, the company service providers, and the third-party asset managers who actually engineered and built the international laundering network in the first place.
So authorities are basically busting the street-level dealer who stuffed some cash under a mattress, but they are leaving the cartel's Ivy League accounting firm completely untouched.
Yep.
Allowing them to just, you know, onboard their next illicit client tomorrow.
That is the enforcement gap at the heart of the report. The individuals generating the criminal proceeds might occasionally go to jail, but the sophisticated infrastructure that enabled the concealment of those proceeds, it remains totally untouched and operational.
But wait, is that a capacity issue or is it a PR issue? Like, are countries just going after low-level offenders because it makes their conviction statistics look great for the Moneyval evaluators? Or do they truly just not have the firepower to take on a cartel's legal team?
Honestly, it's frequently a combination of both. However, Moneyval has explicitly realized that simply demanding a higher volume of convictions isn't the solution anymore.
Right. Quality over quantity.
Exactly. They are now demanding convictions that actually reflect a country's unique risk profile.
What does that mean in practice?
Well, if your jurisdiction serves as a major global hub for international corporate structuring and wealth management, but your courts are only prosecuting low-level domestic drug dealers for self-laundering, your system is failing its mandate.
Ah, because you aren't addressing the actual threat your country poses.
Exactly. You aren't addressing the specialized structures that sustain illicit finance globally. And proving a third-party accountant or lawyer possess the requisite intent, like proving they actually knew the funds were dirty, that requires piercing through attorney-client privilege.
Oh, wow.
It requires getting past their plausible deniability. It is exceptionally difficult. But without that capability, the entire deterrent framework basically crumbles.
Okay, so if prosecutors are struggling to easily lock up the brilliant architects of these laundering schemes, the next logical step, and this seems to be the core focus of the Warsaw Declaration, is to strip away their economic power, hit them where it hurts the most.
Asset recovery. The report frames this as the ultimate effectiveness test.
The ultimate test.
Because a money laundering conviction has almost zero disruptive value if the criminal organization retains the economic benefit of the crime.
Right. If they keep the money, who cares if one guy goes to jail?
Exactly. If they keep the funds, they can finance future operations. They can purchase legitimate businesses to commingle funds, corrupt local officials, and just maintain their influence, even if a few key members are sitting in a prison cell.
Which brings up a really crucial legal distinction made in the sources here, one that I think often gets lost in mainstream headlines. And that's the difference between freezing an asset and confiscating an asset.
Oh, this is a huge point.
Yeah, they sound interchangeable to most people, but operationally they are worlds apart.
Absolutely. So freezing an asset is purely a temporary restraint. It serves to prevent the immediate disposal, transfer, or sale of the property while a criminal investigation is ongoing.
He's basically hitting pause.
Right. Confiscation, on the other hand, what the legal framework calls final deprivation, that means the asset has been permanently transferred to the state through a lawful recovery process.
So the difference between, like, putting a parking boot on a getaway car versus dropping that car into a compactor and crushing it into a cube.
Yes.
The criminals can't drive the booted car today, but the confiscation ensures it is gone forever.
And criminal networks understand this vulnerability perfectly. That is why asset recovery is phenomenally difficult to execute.
Because they hide it.
Exactly. Illicit ownership is almost always deeply obscured. A syndicate does not register a superyacht or a luxury penthouse in the name of a known cartel boss.
Right, that would be too easy.
Those assets are registered to distant relatives, nominee directors, deeply layered holding companies, or professional intermediaries. And the moment an investigation becomes public knowledge, or, you know, a subpoena is leaked, those assets are rapidly transferred or dissipated across borders.
But wait, if an asset is successfully frozen by authorities, isn't the criminal already deprived of using it? Like, why is the final permanent confiscation such a brutal bottleneck for these governments? Why do so many cases just get stuck indefinitely at the freezing stage?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, temporary restraints require an extraordinary level of interagency cooperation and funding.
Really? Just to freeze something?
Consider the logistics required to actually manage seized property. Let's say a government freezes an active working farm, or a fleet of depreciating luxury vehicles, or an operational commercial business.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. The state suddenly assumes the responsibility of maintaining those assets so they don't lose all their market value during a trial. And that trial could easily take 5 to 10 years.
Wow. So the taxpayers are essentially paying to maintain a cartel's yacht.
Basically, it is an enormous financial and logistical burden. And if the final legal recovery process fails in court, maybe due to that lack of specialized judges we discussed earlier, The freeze is immediately lifted.
And the wealth just flows seamlessly back into the criminal ecosystem.
Exactly. So for governments moving forward, the metric isn't how many billions you froze this year. It's how much illicit value was finally permanently recovered and removed relative to the country's actual criminal threat landscape.
But governments can't confiscate an asset if they don't know it exists in the first place. Finding that wealth requires highly actionable, precise financial intelligence. Which brings us to a really systemic breakdown detailed in the sources. The current intelligence gathering system designed to locate this wealth is fundamentally broken.
It really is.
It seems like they're drowning in data, but completely starving for actual actionable intelligence.
Yeah, so the entities responsible for this are financial intelligence units, or FIUs.
Okay.
They act as the critical bridge between the regulated private sector, you know, commercial banks, casinos, and state law enforcement. The private sector is mandated to submit suspicious transaction reports, or STRs, to the FIU.
And what does the FIU do with them?
Their mandate is to analyze this massive influx of data and disseminate actionable intelligence packages to criminal investigators.
But the report highlights a glaring flaw here. These FIUs are receiving just unmanageable volumes of STRs.
Yeah.
And a significant portion of them are essentially useless.
Yep, it's just noise.
They are defensive compliance exercises executed by banks that are terrified of regulatory fines. Let's look at how this mechanism actually plays out in the real world. Say a bank's automated compliance software flags a perfectly legal $10,000 transfer from a migrant worker sending money to their family overseas.
Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
And it flags it simply because the transaction crosses a high-risk border. The bank doesn't have any actual evidence of a crime, but to shield themselves from potential liability, they generate an STR and just dump it on the FIU's desk.
Exactly. And this defensive behavior buries the actual sophisticated illicit transfers under a mountain of bureaucratic noise.
It's crazy.
The institutions often describe an unusual transaction pattern, but they don't offer any hypothesis on the suspected criminal purpose or the relationships between the connected parties or even the ultimate destination of the funds.
So it's just raw data.
Right. High data volume does not equate to an effective intelligence system. If an FIU lacks the advanced technology or the specialized staffing required to triage and prioritize these defensive reports, the data just sits in a server, completely unexamined.
It's the equivalent of a security guard blindly handing a phone book of names to a detective every single morning and calling it intelligence.
That's exactly what it is.
Good luck locating the one actual money launderer hidden in those pages.
Which is why MoneyVal is aggressively pushing for member states to develop mature systems that create a continuous feedback loop.
What does that look like?
Successful investigations and prosecutions have to inform typologies, meaning the specific evolving methods and pathways that criminals are actively using right now.
Okay.
Those typologies must then be shared directly with the private sector to refine and improve their detection algorithms.
Ah, so the banks know exactly what to look for.
Yes. That improved, highly targeted reporting should then support more effective enforcement. Without that symbiotic cycle, filing an STR is nothing more than a hollow bureaucratic output exercise.
And the vulnerabilities become even more pronounced when you look beyond traditional commercial banking. I mean, the European policy framework relies heavily on beneficial ownership registers.
Mm.
These are public or semi-public databases designed to reveal the natural persons who actually control a corporate entity.
Right, the real owners.
But the deep dive notes these registers are frequently populated by unverified self-declarations. Like, a sophisticated criminal network can simply lie on the incorporation forms. They submit a nominee's name instead of the true controller.
It's a huge loophole. And the weaknesses extend far beyond corporate registries. Illicit assets frequently bypass the banking sector entirely and enter the legitimate economy through non-financial channels.
Like where?
Real estate agents, legal notaries, accountants, and dealers in precious metals. They handle massive concentrations of wealth, yet their regulatory supervision is highly fragmented and generally much, much weaker than the oversight applied to international banks.
But wait, is it genuinely the government's job to verify every piece of registry data?
Yeah.
Or are they expecting the private sector to do it? Like, why should we expect a local real estate agent or a regional legal firm to act as a private intelligence agency, forensically reconciling corporate and corporation documents for every client.
Because institutions and professionals cannot legally treat a public registration as conclusive proof of identity anymore.
Really?
It is a fundamental non-negotiable principle of the new AML strategy. If a real estate agent facilitating a multi-million dollar property purchase simply takes a self-declared ownership form at face value...
Without checking it.
Right, without applying enhanced due diligence to understand the client's actual business model or the transaction's inherent risks, that agent becomes a blind conduit for illicit funds. Moneyvel now expects national supervisors to ensure these non-financial sectors are actively verifying ultimate corporate control. And furthermore, when breaches occur, evaluators expect to see genuinely dissuasive, punitive sanctions levied against those professionals.
But just a fine.
Right, not just a minor administrative slap on the wrist.
So recognizing these systemic, multi-layered failures.
Yeah.
You know, the glaring lack of prosecutions for professional enablers, the logistical bottlenecks and asset confiscation, the useless floods of defensive data. Moneyvel has officially initiated a new era of enforcement.
Yes, the sixth evaluation round.
Right.
Moneyvel actually became the first regional body within the FATF global network to commence this new rigorous cycle in 2024.
So this is happening now?
It is. They are utilizing revised FATF recommendations and a completely updated methodology that demands empirical proof of operational performance.
You can't just show them a piece of paper anymore.
No, you can no longer pass an evaluation by pointing to a newly drafted law. The first on-site assessment under this new framework was conducted in Latvia in November 2024, with that mutual evaluation report officially adopted in June 2025.
And others are following.
Yes, comprehensive reports for Serbia, Slovenia, and Armenia immediately followed.
So the overarching message to these jurisdictions is absolutely unmistakable. Passing an amendment or forming a new interagency committee is no longer sufficient. You must empirically prove your courts and police are disrupting crime.
Exactly.
However, the Warsaw Declaration explicitly warned that this aggressive, high-pressure shift comes with severe, unintended societal risks.
It does. When you apply massive existential regulatory pressure on financial institutions to ensure they aren't facilitating crime, the most common corporate reaction is excessive de-risking.
De-risking. How does that actually manifest for everyday people or organizations?
It manifests as institutions wholesale severing access to financial services for entire categories of clients, simply to avoid the complex compliance headache.
Wow. Just cutting them off entirely.
Yeah. This disproportionately impacts legitimate nonprofit organizations delivering aid in conflict zones, or migrant communities relying on international remittances, or really any customer geographically connected to a higher risk region.
So what does this all mean? The policy pendulum is swinging so forcefully towards strict effectiveness and aggressive enforcement that we risk breaking the financial system for the innocent populations who actually rely on it the most.
That is the danger, yes.
And the report also highlights the deeply concerning danger of autocratic governments misusing these incredibly powerful financial crime laws. Like under the guise of AML enforcement, state actors can freeze the assets of political opponents, investigative journalists, civil society groups.
It's a very real threat. And the Warsaw Declaration also dedicated significant attention to the growing integration of artificial intelligence and compliance systems.
Oh, AI is everywhere now.
It is. And automated machine learning models are highly effective for processing that unmanageable volume of transactional data we discussed earlier.
Right, to sift through the noise.
Exactly. However, poorly governed AI models inherently reproduce and amplify historical bias.
Let's explore how that AI bias actually functions in a banking environment.
Sure. So an AI model trained on decades of historical compliance data might learn to statistically associate a specific geographic region or even a particular ethnic naming convention with high risk.
Oh, no.
Consequently, the automated system might flag an innocent humanitarian NGO operating near a conflict zone.
Just automatically.
Yes. It doesn't flag them because there is any actual forensic evidence of terrorist financing, but simply because the algorithm found a statistical correlation.
And the bank just blindly follows it.
Often, yes. The AI model generates a completely unexplained, opaque decision, directing severe regulatory scrutiny and account closures toward protected communities without any sufficient evidential basis. But wait, if I am a bank executive, right, and I'm facing severe reputational damage and multi-million dollar regulatory fines for inadvertently processing a transaction for a sanctioned entity, Isn't it perfectly rational and frankly safer for my shareholders to deploy an AI tool to automatically block anyone from a high-risk region? Like, why should the bank take on that risk?
That is the ultimate tension here. And it raises an important question about the fundamental purpose and ethical boundaries of the international financial system.
Which is?
Well, the Warsaw Declaration made it explicitly clear that AML policy must remain risk-based, proportionate, and strictly consistent with international human rights standards.
Okay.
A higher-risk customer, such as a humanitarian NGO operating in a complex environment, requires a nuanced, informed human assessment.
Not a robot.
Exactly. Their structural complexities does not warrant automated algorithmic exclusion. The operational goal of the FNTF framework is to detect and disrupt sophisticated criminals, not to financially exile vulnerable populations, simply because it is cheaper for a bank's compliance department to rely on a biased algorithm.
Okay.
That perfectly encapsulates the incredible high-stakes tightrope that governments, regulators, and global financial institutions are currently walking.
It really is a balancing act.
So, if we synthesize the core journey of this deep dive, I think the overriding takeaway from Moneyval's shifting strategy is that the era of formal, paper-based compliance is entirely dead.
It is over.
The future of combating illicit finance, whether we're talking about transnational organized crime, grand political corruption, or complex sanctions evasion, it relies entirely on a continuous, effective operational cycle.
Exactly. Converting risk understanding into precise detection.
Converting that detection into actionable, high-value intelligence.
Translating that intelligence into complex, multi-jurisdictional investigations.
And finally, converting those investigations into the permanent confiscation and removal of criminal value from the economy.
That's the cycle.
And that brings this entire framework right back to you, listening right now. Whether you are a financial crime leader, actively evaluating your own institution's vulnerabilities, or just an everyday professional wondering why your cross-border property transfer is scrutinized with so much paperwork, you are living in the operational reality of Moneyval's sixth round.
You really are.
Your institutions, your commercial banks, and your national legal systems are now being rigorously judged on whether they actually disrupt criminal networks in the real world. Not just whether they have a heavily drafted manual sitting on a shelf that claims they do.
The fortress cannot simply look secure from the outside anymore. The guards actually have to demonstrate they know how to stop the thieves.
Which leaves me with one final thought to mull over. Something that isn't explicitly detailed in the report, but feels like the inevitable elephant in the room here.
What's that?
If this new aggressive standard of effectiveness actually succeeds, like if governments successfully close all the historical loopholes in traditional banking, real estate, and corporate legal sectors, and law enforcement becomes world-class at permanently confiscating physical and digital assets, will organize crime simply abandon fiat currency and the traditional global economy entirely?
Oh, wow.
Right. Are we inadvertently pushing illicit finance into completely untraceable underground barter networks and dark pool economies where no legislation, no matter how perfectly enforced, could ever reach it?
Well, that is the multi-billion dollar question facing the next generation of financial intelligence.
We will leave you with that to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.